This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. According to a study released by the U.S. Census Bureau last week, American men still pull in bigger paychecks than women working the same job. For example, the median for male dentists is $110,000, while for females, it's $68,000. A woman dishwasher will likely make $2,000 less per year than her male counterpart. In sum, for every dollar earned by a man, in 2002, a woman pocketed 77 cents. On one hand, that's a considerable improvement. In 1960, it was 60 cents to the dollar, and that's gone up a nickel since 1998. On the other hand, that's still a significant gap. Some experts say that equal pay will always be blocked for a variety of reasons: overt discrimination, the glass ceiling, because women are less likely to work year-round and more inclined to take extended time off. They also point out that some women make less because of their choice to take time off, to raise children maybe, and enjoy life more. Later in the program, a look at the movie we would and would not want to see remade. But first, the pay gap between men and women. Is this an issue where you work? If you're an employer, do you still consider sex as a factor when you're hiring? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now is Dan Weinberg, the author of the U.S. Census Bureau study. He's also chief of the Bureau's Housing and Household Economic Statistics Division. He's with us by phone from his office in Maryland. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
Your office looked at, in this survey, at over 500 different occupations. In how many of those jobs did women make the same amount as men?
In only 11 occupations out of those 505 did we find that they had equal earnings.
And which kinds of jobs were those?
Well, it's quite a variety. The highest were hazardous materials removal workers, a couple of the others, telecommunications, line installers, meeting and convention planners, dining room and cafeteria attendants, and bartender helpers. It's really quite different occupation.
Mm-hmm. But as I understand, male and female workers who remove hazardous waste say they earn equal amounts, as your survey found, but women don't make up the equal half of the half the workforce.
Well, that's true. In that one you mentioned, hazardous materials removal workers, women are only about 10% of the year-round full-time workers in that occupation. Out of the 11 I mentioned, there are only two, actually, where women are the majority. Meeting and convention planners is one. The other one are dietitians and nutritionists.
Now, you studied doctors, physicians, and surgeons. Females make less than their male counterparts, but you also suggest there may be reasons for that.
Well, that's right. And we weren't able to determine the specialty for the physicians. For example, a woman might choose to work as a pediatrician or in perhaps a health maintenance organization more often than a man, there might be more neurosurgeons perhaps who would be paid more. But in a form like the census, the decennial census, people just fill out MD when they're a doctor, and we can't make that distinction.
As wages go up, according to your study, the gap in earnings goes up.
Yes, it starts out at the lowest end of the earnings distribution. Women are making almost 90% of what men are, but by the time you get to the upper end, it drops even below 50%.
So did the amount of education would seem to have an impact, at least on the gap?
Well, it does, but remember, women and men are both getting more education. So even when you look at differences controlling for education, there's still a gap remaining.
In your conclusion, you say there is still a substantial gap in median earnings between men and women that is unexplained even after controlling for work experience. I was wondering if you could elaborate on that.
Well, what I did in this study was to look at year-round full-time workers, and that is people who work 35 hours or more a week and 50 or more weeks a year. Some have suggested, well, people who work 60 hours would normally get more than people who work 40 hours a week, and that's probably true. So I didn't control completely for their work during the week, and also don't really have a good measure of how long women in particular are out of the labor force, say, to raise children.
Mm-hmm. Our number, if you'd like to join our conversation, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, the email address, totn@npr.org. Let's get a call in from Todd, who's with us from St. Louis, Missouri.
Hi, Neil. Thank you. It was great to meet you when you were in St. Louis.
Oh, thanks.
My comment is I saw this survey also published in the St. Louis paper, the Post-Dispatch, and it seemed like there were some pretty broad categories like doctor, dentist, lawyer. And what I've noticed, at least anecdotally, is that there's a lot more men who seem to stay on further and go into some of the specialties, especially surgeons and that sort of thing. And I was wondering if your guest had found a similar result and if that could greatly skew those results.
Dan Weinberg?
Well, physicians and surgeons is one of the broader categories. I've got over 500,000 of them in that very broad category. And I think it is likely that when you specialize, you do tend to make more. But this difference between men and women holds up even in the more narrowly defined ones like optometrist, actuary, nuclear engineer, and so forth.
Todd, thanks for the question.
Thank you.
And thanks for supporting KWMU.
Sure.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
And Dan Weinberg, we appreciate your time today.
Glad to help.
Dan Weinberg is the author of the U.S. Census Bureau study. He's the chief of the Bureau's Housing and Household Economic Statistics Division, and he was with us by phone from his office in Maryland. Now joining us to discuss why there is a pay gap between men and women is Heidi Hartman. She's president of the Institute for Women's Policy. She's with us here in Studio 3A. Good to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
And also with us here in the studio is Christine Rosen, the co-author of Women's Figures, an illustrated guide to the economic progress of women in America, also a resident fellow at the Ethics and Pay Public Policy Center. Thanks for you for coming in, too. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Heidi, your institute released its own report last week looking at earnings gap. You took a slightly different approach. Were your findings similar to the Census Bureau's? Is gender discrimination being eased?
Well, the findings are similar in that both reports found considerable difference in the earnings between women and men,
mm-hmm.
and considerable occupational segregation, women and men working in different occupations, and even when they work in the same occupations, tending to pay less. But the new angle that we put on this study was to look at how much women and men earn in total across 15 years. And because some of the women are working fewer hours, taking years off, and when they do work full-time year-round, they're still earning less. Overall, we found that over 15 years, women earn only 38% of what men earn.
38%?
I was very surprised by that. I've been studying this for 30 years, and I was surprised how low that was, because this isn't really old data. This is the 15 years ending in 1998. This is pretty recent.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that women are working more and more. Absolutely, the data all show that. And so, in fact, we then went back and we looked at the prior 15 years, and we found that then they earned even less, only about 29%.
So the same trend, but with a much lower figure. Obviously, you're measuring different things also. But it was interesting to look at one result of your study that suggested men and women both pay the same penalty for taking an extended time off, about a 30% drop in earnings, but women tend to take more extended leaves.
Yes. A lot of studies have found that the penalty really isn't any less for men. And but if the man has a higher wage level to begin with, and someone is going to take time off in order to take care of children, it does make sense for the higher earner to work more and the lower earner to take off, even if they're both going to lose 30%. It's better to lose 30% of the lower wage. And so because of the wage discrimination in the labor market, a woman's choice to stay home with her children, which many of them make that choice, is really kind of, we say, a constrained choice.
Mm-hmm. Christine Rosen, is the reason for all of this discrimination or other factors at work?
Well, I think there are other factors at work, and while I agree with Ms. Hartman that there are certain constraints, and I would also point out that I'm not someone who would argue that there is no such thing as sex discrimination in the labor market these days. However, it's a much more complicated problem than we often hear discussed. For example, the truth is that less than half of married women with children under the age of 18 work full time. So we're talking about certain groups of women. And the other thing is that's interesting, and I part of what was so intriguing about Ms. Hartman's study was that we find these are choices women are making. Now, whether or not those choices are constrained is an interesting discussion of, say, something like false consciousness or other limited options. I think there are interesting debates that we could have about flexible workplaces. However, what a lot of people draw from this data is an argument for greater federal government intervention to correct what they perceive as a problem of discrimination. And I actually think it's a bit more complicated than that if mm-hmm. you start looking and parsing out these choices.
What do you mean by, Heidi, when you say constrained choices?
Well, I think if women, for example, we've done a study on low-income women, asking them what kind of occupations they would like to get training for. And many of them express interest in non-traditional occupations for women, like computer occupations. And then we ask the counselors, what do you recommend? And they say, oh, we don't recommend that to them because these people aren't prepared. So, you know, that's the kind of constraint. You may have been constrained when you picked your training, when you picked your college major. You're constrained in the sense that there isn't available childcare that's close to your home or that you feel comfortable with. You're constrained because even tax laws disadvantage married women working. It's a so-called marriage penalty for women who make about the same as their husbands. There's a fairly high tax rate.
Mm-hmm. Christine, did you want to come back on that?
Well, I agree that there are certain constraints. The question I would then pose is, whose responsibility is it to lift those constraints, and how do you do that in an effective way? And I think a lot of the solutions we hear bandied about are one-size-fits-all solutions, paid family leave or you know, efforts to craft wage structures and impose wage rates that would raise the wages in female-dominated professions, for example, so that they're comparable with men's. And I think then we're talking about getting involved in the free market in a way that Americans, as a rule, haven't been that comfortable doing.
Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. Our number is 800-989-8255, and let's go to Ed, another caller from St. Louis.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to pass on a little anecdote. My wife worked for a major Fortune 500 company, was there about 20 years, started as a clerk typist, worked her way up to director of international finance. And they were doing a global search for a new position. And after months of negotiations, they finally brought a guy in from Brazil. And when they made him the offer, my wife said, well, we have a problem because we now have two candidates. And, of course, everyone was shocked. What, you know, who was it? She said, well, that's $16,000 less than I make, and he'd be working for someone working for me.
That's an odd situation, Ed.
Well, and it gets even more strange when the director of personnel said, well, we always pay women less.
That's illegal.
Of course it is. You know, and, but, you know, fortunately her pay was immediately bumped up a bit, but it just kind of shows the whole mindset, I guess, of a lot of major corporations.
Ed's call, I think, Heidi, illustrates a point that a lot of experts in this field talk about. A lot of this is cultural.
It is cultural, but we do have laws on the books that you really can't pay people differently for the same jobs if the difference is based on race or sex. You know, there was another recent case in a big company, a stockbroker in San Antonio, a woman just got a $2.2 million judgment against Merrill Lynch because it was a pattern of bias against women stockbrokers in the Merrill Lynch office in San Antonio. So we have a lot of evidence that this bias still exists. And I think the American people are comfortable with the government getting involved in eliminating that kind of bias.
Mm-hmm.
The government already is involved. We have laws on the books, and we should obviously, I think we agree that those need to continue to be enforced. But I think Americans become a little less comfortable with things such as government-sponsored daycare programs, for example, or wage-setting, comparable worth legislation. This is a different and in degree and kind, a different kind of involvement than we've had so far.
Ed, if you need a lawyer, this one sounds like such a slam dunk. I'll go back and go to law school, and if you wait for me, I'll take the case, okay?
I'm two jumps ahead of you, Neil.
Darn it.
Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for the call, Ed. We're going to talk more about the differences between men and women's pay, and we'll take more of your calls when we come back from break. Our number, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the continuing pay gap between men and women's wages. Is this an issue where you work? You're invited to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN at NPR.org. Our guests here in Studio 3A, Heidi Hartman, co-author of a new report on the earnings gap, president of the Institute for Women's Policy Research, and Christine Rosen, co-author of Women's Figures, an illustrated guide to the economic progress of women in America, a resident fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. And let's get another caller on the line. Ryan is with us from Phoenix, Arizona.
Hi there, Neil. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm an employer here that we hire recent MBA graduates, and what I find often, and this is happening for a position we're currently hiring for, is that when in an interview, when we ask a candidate what range of salary they'd be interested in working for the company for, realize we don't publish the salary.
Mm-hmm.
Women tend to offer up a price or a range for their salary lower than what men usually offer. I'm just wondering if there are any comments of that from your panel.
Just let me ask you, how much lower, just in by ballpark?
Well, I haven't quantified it much, but what we're finding, perhaps 10 to 20,000 less for a salaried position that might be paying $70,000 or $60,000.
Do you hire any men?
Oh yes, we do.
Well, okay. Any speculation as to why, Christine Rosen?
Well, I think this points to what you were suggesting earlier, which is that there are some cultural questions here, and those are a little more difficult to solve through particular legislation. And there is some sociological and psychological research that shows that women often, not only do they not demand as much money at the get-go, but they often won't go back in for raises and ask for raises as frequently as men will. And now that's something, obviously, we want to discourage. We want women to be just as bold in demanding and getting paid what they're worth. The other part of the cultural equation, though, I think, and it's revealed in the census data as well as in the Institute for Women's Policy Research report, is the accumulation of these choices that women are making. And again, the question I think we all should be grappling with isn't, is there discrimination? There might be some. We have laws on the books. But how would we change things? Is it going to be possible to get men to use family leave policies, for example, as often as women? Because right now they don't. And if that's not the case, do we need to rethink how we're even approaching the work and family balance issue?
Heidi Hartman, how do you work on to stop having women sell themselves short?
Well, I think that as an economist, I have to say that sometimes I think these behaviors of women that people think aren't appropriate might seem appropriate. If you really think you are discriminated against or you're more likely to be fired if you ask for a raise because you sense there's bias against you because you are a woman, you know, that might actually intimidate you. So it may not always be irrational that women may have these behaviors. But to the extent that women can learn to be bolder and negotiate and ask for what they feel themselves to be worth, I think, of course, that would be a great improvement.
Mm-hmm.
I think in terms of the kinds of things Christine was talking about, you know, what do we want to do as a society about things like family leave and child care? I think we do want to have more public investment in those areas because I view children as a social good. If my children are reared well, then that's good for you. They're not committing crimes on your property. And so all of us have a stake in how all the children are reared. And, you know, we're constrained by our incomes. We can't buy the best child care, all of us. And if the government cares about having healthy, productive children who are well-reared, then helping families with those expenses would be good. I think that's a justifiable social investment. And I think the arrangements we have now are very restrictive for men as well. If men want to take time off to help with the children, they face a sort of opprobrium for that reason. My husband was at GAO, and he asked to work 75% when our first child was born, and they told him no. And I said, Jack, you better go back in and ask them what they would do if it was a mother. So we did. And they said, oh, of course we'd give her the time off.
Yeah.
And then he said, well, you better give me the time off. And then they did.
Yeah. Ryan, I just wanted to ask you, when you eventually hire people, do you hire them at the same salary?
No, all people, we negotiate. Everybody negotiates their own salary. So it just depends on what really the candidate asks for. And obviously we hire the best candidate. And this particular position, our best candidate is a female, and she'll get hired, but we're surprised that she actually asks for less than some of the other candidates who are men who are not as well qualified.
How big is your firm, Ryan?
We hire about 13,000 employees worldwide, but corporate, about 1,000.
Well, if I were the women at your firm, I would probably start filing a class action suit and suggest that we may be underpaid because you do that negotiation. I mean, most firms that large would tend to have salary scales for certain kinds of jobs, and they would tend to review them and make sure they're not paying women less than men in similar kinds of jobs. I'm sure you're doing that, too.
Yeah, I'm sure they are, too, although I can't speak to what our HR department is doing.
Ryan, thanks very much, and we want to look into hiring a lawyer next. But
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Let's talk to Jane, and Jane is on the line with us from Kansas City.
Yeah, I am. And I just have been listening to you, enjoying it, and do agree that little government interference and setting all sorts of rules and regulations is probably not exactly the wisest way to go in micromanaging how our free market economy works. But I've always thought that part of the problem with why this disparity has been able to continue in our culture is we all feel, not we, mostly the culture feels so secretive about how much any individual is making.
Mm-hmm.
Not in the general terms of a job with a certain title should make a certain pay range. No, I'm talking about Mary Smith makes thus and so. So my thought was, how about if a law could be enacted or a requirement be enacted that at some central repository, now that we obviously have wonderful computer systems that could carry all this data, everybody's actual rate of pay, other than obviously the IRS knows how much we're making, be available as public record. I think we would find once everybody kind of knew what everybody was making, it's kind of like, then there might be more overall pressure just from the culture and the populace for more equality, I would think.
Transparency, or is that
parity?
Well, let me just ask Christine Rosen, is that transparency or is that infringement on rights?
My privacy knee is just jerking wildly. I'm afraid that although I understand the sympathy, I have some sympathy with what the caller was suggesting, which is a little bit more information available to as many mm-hmm. people as possible so that when, like the previous caller was discussing, when a woman or a man goes into interview for a job, they have a sense of what the range of salaries are. There are ways of finding out that information as individuals. I mean, you can do a little research yourself for jobs. I would not approve of publishing people's salaries because I think above and beyond the information it might give to other potential people looking to get into those fields, it's going to give a lot of other information to people who probably shouldn't have that. I just think that's too broad a privacy violation to justify the information that you can also probably cobble together with a little more research on, as individuals.
Heidi, go ahead and respond to this, but I also wonder at lower pay scales, where there is greater transparency, a lot of mm-hmm. jobs have union contracts or various other kinds of things where there's set out parameters, there does seem to be less difference in what men and women make.
Absolutely. Those 11 jobs that Daniel Weinberg was talking about at the top of the hour, many of those are union jobs or civil service jobs mm-hmm. where the salaries are known. And I think the caller has an excellent point that where salaries are known, there tends to be more equality. There actually is a bill in Congress designed to prevent employers from punishing workers from revealing their salaries to each other and talking about it. There are many employers who forbid their employees from discussing their salaries. And there is a bill proposed to prevent punishment for that.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be one step. There's another bill that does suggest that employers would be required to show the average pay by category of job for men and women. So you could look at parking lot attendants and see that male and female ones are paid differently. And that, I don't think, is that much of an infringement of privacy.
Jane, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Before
we let our guests go, I did want to ask you both, do you think there is always going to be a difference between what men make and what women make? Heidi, you first.
Absolutely not. I am a confirmed optimist. I believe that we're making a lot of progress. We've seen it, and I think it's going to continue. And I think part of the reason for that is that men and women both feel this is an unfair situation. Their families are being hurt by the fact that women are working just as hard and not making the same money. And it's an unstable situation. Women want the independence that equal pay would give them. They wind up with divorce now. You know, half of women 65 and over don't have men to live with anymore. So they really need equal pay. So I think everything is moving toward equal pay. And at that point, men and women will be more equal caregivers than they are now.
Mm-hmm. Your views, Christine?
I guess this makes me the pessimist in the room, but I think as long, unless and until men and women make the same choices about both their work lives and their home lives, in other words, men choose as often as women to be caregivers for their children and as often women choose to be in the workforce as often as men want to, then we will continue to see gaps, as we still do in other, you know, married and unmarried people have a wage gap as well. I mean, there are always these gaps in the economy. So I would say I would just be cautious about trying to legislate that sort of world when it comes to making individual social choices that are right for individual families.
Christine Rosen, co-author of Women's Figures, an Illustrated Guide to the Economic Progress of Women in America, a resident fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, and Heidi Hartman, president of the Institute for Women's Policy. Thanks very much to you both for coming in.
Thank you.
Joining us now to discuss how negotiations play a part in the pay gap is Sara Loshever. She's co-author of Women Don't Ask, Negotiation and the Gender Divide. She's with us from the studios of member station WBUR in Boston. Good of you to join us today.
Hi, Neil.
In your book, you say men initiate negotiations four times as often as women. Why does that matter?
Well, men ask for things that are going to improve their situations or, in this case, get them more money, much more than women do. And as a result, they accumulate more wealth and women lag behind.
Why don't women negotiate more?
Well, it's pretty complicated. Your earlier guests were talking about cultural factors. There's very powerful socialization of females from the day they're born that really teaches them that they should stand and wait, that they should do a great job and wait to be rewarded and recognized, that they should focus on the needs of others, and that we don't like greedy, pushy, selfish women. And in fact, when women act a little bit more pushy or a little bit more aggressive, and of course, those aren't the words I would use to describe their behavior, when they do ask more, they're often rebuffed. Both men and women in our society don't like other women that they perceive as too aggressive.
So
women
behavior
hang
that's
back.
Behavior acceptable in men is not acceptable in women.
Absolutely. There's a definite double standard about that.
And this, from your description, it almost sounds like it goes back to the playground.
It goes back definitely to the playground. Women learn this from the kinds of games they're guided into playing on the playground. They're taught this from the chores they're given, the toys they're given, the books and movies they're given, and the behavior that they observe in adults around them. It starts very early and continues all the way through until women are adults. So not only are they reluctant to ask, they often don't have a good sense of their market value. They don't know what they're worth. Their work is worth because they're not accustomed to thinking in terms of their market value.
Sara Loshever is co-author of the book Women Don't Ask, Negotiation and the Gender Divide. She's joining us from the studios of member station WBUR in Boston. You're listening to Talk of the Nation, which is coming to you from NPR News. And one thing is to state that this exists. You've also done and collected some surveys to suggest how damaging it can be. Someone entering a relatively low-paying profession, not negotiating her first job, you say this can cost her more than $500,000 by the time she retires.
Yes, that's a very shocking figure. People go to that. And that's really someone just, you know, getting offered $25,000 a year to start. Someone entering a high-paying profession, if she doesn't negotiate that first raise, even if she gets equal raises, percentage increases every year she works, will lose about $1.6 million over the course of her career. So this one-time negotiation, huge sacrifice if women don't step up and ask for more.
Let's get another caller on the line. Kathy's with us from Tallahassee.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm an attorney, and I've kind of been on both sides of the negotiation table. And what I have found is that women definitely tend to ask for less money to start and tend to, when the negotiations begin, tend to take one of the first offers made and don't try to negotiate up from that. I've seen it as a shareholder in my firm, and I was wondering, is it just part of women in general tending to be our social makeup is that we tend to try to get along and take what we're given?
Yeah, before we get a response from Sara Loshever, Kathy, is that the way you behave in negotiations?
Well, when I started my first job, yes, I did. I've actually switched firms, and my second job, I negotiated much and from a better position, I think, and also I was much stronger in what I asked for.
And did you get it?
Yes, I did.
Okay. Well, let's get a response then to your question from Sara Loshever.
Well, I think that's absolutely right, that women are taught from the time they're very young to protect relationships, that relationships are very important. And many women perceive negotiation as an arena of conflict. And so when they ask for something, someone says, you can have, you know, whatever, they often concede way too soon rather than going back a couple more rounds and asking for more, because they confuse this disagreement about the material of the negotiation with a conflict between the two people or the people involved in the negotiation. And so that makes them nervous and they want to back down quickly.
I need to see that it's just business.
Exactly.
Okay.
That's exactly what I've found.
Well, thanks for the call, Kathy.
Thank you.
I wonder, Sara Loshefer, are younger women, do you think, we hear about, much more confident than their older sisters, their older counterparts? Is that a factor, do you think?
Unfortunately, it's not. I interviewed almost 100 people for my book, and almost without exception, the women in their 20s said to me, this is not our problem. This is a boomer problem. We identify what we want. We ask for what we want. We ask for as much as our male peers. And unfortunately, all the data shows that that is not the case. In fact, women in their 20s ask for what they want about as much or slightly less than older women. So the idea that we've reached gender parity, you know, the fact that younger women believe that is a little dangerous, actually.
I wonder, you also suggest that women should not negotiate, they should negotiate as often and as be as demanding as men, but not the same way that men do.
That's right. Style is very important. It's been well documented, and many women have seen this in the workplace, that women who ask the way men do in a direct way that might be perceived as just, you know, competent and appropriate in a man are often perceived as too aggressive or too pushy. So women need to adopt some of the social mannerisms that we require of women or that we think women should use. They need to smile more. They need to make a lot of warm eye contact. They need to come off as likable, because to be influential, a woman needs to be perceived as likable. And of course, a negotiation is a mutual influence process.
Well, Sara Loshefer, thanks very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Sara Loshefer, co-author of Women Don't Ask, Negotiation and the Gender Divide. She was with us from the studios of member station WBUR in Boston. When we come back from a short break, we're going to talk with the host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Peter Sagal, about Hollywood's latest stable of movie remakes. Peter Sagal credited as the screenwriter on a remake of Dirty Dancing himself. So which movies would you like to see remade, and which ones do you think are, well, untouchable for one reason or another? Give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or send us email, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.